Fatal five-way rules. First woman to gain pinfall or submission will win this matchup. Here's the hook of the leg, and Bailey.
Dana Brooke has been eliminated.
So apparently I had my my rules mixed up. This is an elimination match.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client.
Mama Monster.
Conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Fat delete.
You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
I feel so lame right now. Thank God you guys couldn't see what I just did. I actually did the John Cena thing where he salutes before he goes out to the ring. And he looks at the camera and he says, time to go to work. I just did that here before I hit the record button. I am officially lame. I'll tell you what's not lame. This is episode 517 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, October 15, 2017. I am the Solid Monster. Midway through October already, which only brings us that much closer to the Halloween episode, one of my favorite shows of the year. Hope everybody is having themselves a great week. It's been a great weekend here for the Sound Off. I just wrapped a really fun half-hour interview yesterday with Wolfgang. You guys know Wolfgang is a favorite of mine ever since the UK tournament. Big star in ICW over there in the UK. Officially an NXT star. We've seen him on there a few times. Could not be a nicer guy. Really great story. I think you guys will enjoy it, even if you're not that familiar with the UK scene. If you're not that familiar with Wolfgang, you will be after this interview. It's 30 minutes. It's up on the YouTube channel right now as a Sound Off Extra. For those of you who want to download the audio, as always, you can find a link to the audio file in the video description down below. Please go check that video out. Give it a thumbs up if you would be so kind. We talk about a lot of stuff. We cover his current deal with WWE and why it's so unique. I did ask him about the rumors, batted around rumors of there being a WWE UK show on the network. So he shares what he knows about that. We talk about his family background, his mom, some stuff that you guys may not be aware of as far as that goes. And of course, his time in ICW, their Big Fear and Loathing show, which is coming up next month. They have a tour coming up he's going to be part of. He even floated the idea maybe of there being a Team UK. Not that he's heard anything about that, but that would be something very cool that he would want to see. And I agree. So if there's anybody listening to this, let's make that happen. Let's get a Team UK match going on at Survivor Series this year. So anyway, that's up on the YouTube channel right now. My thanks again to Wolfgang. He had some really nice stuff to say about me on his Twitter, which just blew me away. So I thank him for the kind words and leave feedback under the video. Audible, a lot of you guys I made aware last week that the Jim Ross book is available for free right now on audible.com. This is JR's, I guess if you don't count the cookbook that he came out with all those years ago, this is technically it would be his second book. But for all intents and purposes, this is his first big book about his life and his career. I think it cuts off around the time of the Monday Night Wars. I'm not entirely sure. I haven't had a chance to read it yet. You guys can listen to it. The audiobook version is available right now, and you can get it for free. I was a little disappointed. I thought more people would take advantage of it last week. So if you want to support the show, because every time you sign up using our link, we get a little bit of a kickback there from Audible, and you guys get a free book in exchange. All you got to do is go to audibletrial.com/solidmonster, sign up for the trial, 30 days, you could try out the service, you don't get billed, and if you cancel before the 30 days are up, so you don't get billed, you get to keep whatever book you cash in on, and it doesn't have to be the Jim Ross book. That's the latest one that's out. The AJ Lee book was probably the biggest book that came out that people used our link for. That was earlier this year. You guys were monsters when it came to signing up for the AJ Lee book, Crazy Is My Superpower. You could always cash in on that one. Don't forget the Death of WCW, which is hilarious and sad all at the same time. You can get that with our Audible book. I know Mick Foley's got a new book coming out. In fact, this Tuesday, you can pre-order Mick Foley's new book, which is called Saint Mick, My Journey from Hardcore Legend to Santa's Jolly Elf, which is narrated by Foley himself, as the JR book is. So whichever one you want, use our link, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Get yourself a free book, and it's an easy way to show your support for the show. Another way you can do that, of course, is by PayPal. Entirely up to you. You guys make donations as you see fit on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get your wrestling nickname. You guys know the drill. I want to say thank you to all of our VIPs this week, including John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, Chuck Lunatic Lentz. Haven't heard from the Lunatic in a while. Louise, I hope I hear from you for the 10-year anniversary show in a couple of weeks. You guys were unbelievable when it came to the donations and the shout-outs on episode 500. Well, we got the 10-year anniversary show coming up in a few weeks, so I expect to hear from all of you guys. Luis Hercules Hernandez, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Out of Control Cody Thomas, The Florida Freebird Brian Becerra, The Reflection of Perfection Abraham Lara, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Masgrave Micah Harshaw, Aim for the Head Andrew Jorlog, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Stephen Handyman Halistic, The Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T, The Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Danger Dan Larson, first time donator, as is Mighty Mark Stringer, Misery Inc., Chris Matthews, The Demon Temptress, Samantha Krasinski, who I had the chance to meet at our SummerSlam weekend meetup this year. One of the many cool people I got to meet that weekend was Sam. And the Crown Prince of Violence, Colin Vignault. There's a new RPG fantasy wrestling website that you guys can check out. It's designed by one of our listeners. It's called SXEWrestling.com. It's a forum-based role-playing game, basically, where you can choose your favorite wrestlers, you post promos to trash-talk other people, and then based on your interaction with other members, you get booked on shows. They determine the results with a simulator. I guess results get posted every Sunday. It's also 100% free to play. So go to SXEWrestling.com. You could sign up there. You know, I remember hosting my own league, very similar to this, back in the 90s. And all of the different egos I had to deal with, it was exhausting. Like, people take these things so seriously. You would be maybe you wouldn't be amazed. I mean, you probably know what I'm talking about. But you have no idea the AIM. Remember the AOL Instant Messenger? The AIM conversations I used to have with people on a daily basis. I'd have dueling windows open with people who absolutely just hated each other and they were complaining and bitching to me about this and that. I'll tell you what, I don't envy the job of a wrestling promoter. I do not envy them at all. It takes a special kind of person, I think, to deal with that stuff on a daily basis. Speaking of AIM, I saw that AOL, or I guess Verizon now, which owns AOL, is discontinuing AIM for good on December 15th. AIM is no more. After that, it's gone forever. It's getting the Shawn Michaels retirement, not the Terry Funk retirement. I mean, it's hard to get too sad about it. It's probably been, let's see, how long has it been since I've even logged into my AIM account? Probably every bit of like 10 or 11 years since I've even logged into my AIM account, which is still active. Just haven't used it. But that, I mean, that was the way everybody used to chat back then, right? And then MySpace popped up, Facebook popped up, Twitter. Now you have Snapchat and all this other crap I can't even keep up with. I mean, AIM is a dinosaur compared to that stuff. It won't be getting any You Still Got It chance. So you have until December 15th, for those of you who did not know, to log into your AIM account. If you missed it, I've got my Sound Off Extra review up on YouTube for Hell in a Cell last weekend. Final poll results, over 3,300 votes, which is a pretty healthy number. 75% thumbs up, 25% thumbs down. So you people seem to really enjoy the show. I thought the two Hell in a Cell matches saved this show. Especially the tag team title match, the Usos and the New Day. I think that may well end up being the sleeper feud of the year in WWE when this year is over. The Sami Zayn heel turn in the main event, saving Kevin Owens. I thought that was a nice little swerve. And it put Sami right back, not even back. I mean, this is really his first time in the main event mix on that show, which I think is where he belongs. I think he's earned the right to at least have a shot in a high profile feud, given what they've had him doing all year, which is a whole lot of nothing. If Jinder Mahal can be WWE champion, a Kevin Owens, Sami Zayn heel team, I think, can work on top too. Shane McMahon is a crazy man, which we already knew going into the show. That's not news to anybody. Diving off the top of the cell. People Magazine embarrassed themselves this week. They ran a story on their website, borrowing from a story that ran on WWE.com, playing up Shane's storyline injuries as if they were real. They fell for it. They fell for the whole, this guy suffered four different injuries and was taken to a local medical facility nonsense. Severe neck trauma, fractured ribs, dislocated shoulder. They reported that as if it were real. They even referred to Shane in their headline as the commissioner, as if that is a real position in the company. And then by the end of the week, they were forced to walk back their story. They actually had to go back and update their story, complete with the headline, and this is what I loved, Shane McMahon not severely injured after stunt fall. Just an embarrassment to what is a, or look, say what you want to about like the tabloid nature of People and all that. They're not even the worst when it comes to that. People Magazine is a reputable publication. I mean, I know this from what I do for a living. You know, I've pitched stories to them and dealt with them before. They're a reputable outlet. For them to run a story like that, even just on their website, as if it were real, is an embarrassment. Neville appears to be done with WWE. There's a lot of contradictory information out there about this story. A lot of different websites that are reporting conflicting things about the whole Neville situation. The story, though, every story, as different as they may be, comes to the same conclusion, which is that Neville is not coming back anytime soon, if ever. Ryan Satin, I believe, had the story first. The rumor, which he wasn't able to verify, at least not at the time, was that Neville had walked out before Raw on Monday, where he was set to lose to Enzo Amore in a lumberjack match in the main event of the show. Dave Meltzer later on reported that when Neville found out he was losing again to Enzo, that's when he walked out of Raw, which obviously forced them to scramble. They had to book Kalisto to win the championship over Enzo in the main event. That was a whole last-minute rewrite because Neville walked out. He says the belief is that Neville is gone, even though WWE says he has not quit and he is not gone. And they could technically be right by saying he isn't gone, but that's only because they haven't granted him his release yet. So yes, technically he would not be gone. He would still be under contract. However, I noticed that Mike Johnson over at PW Insider, he's usually pretty on point with these stories, says that Neville, in fact, did not walk out of Raw on Monday night. It would be physically impossible for him to do that because he wasn't even at Raw to begin with. In fact, he wasn't on the road at all last weekend, and they had Mustafa Ali replacing him on a lot of the house shows and matches against Enzo Amore. He says the plan was to do Neville against Enzo on Monday, which tells me, I guess, they thought Neville was going to be flying in and showing up. Maybe one hand doesn't know what the other hand is doing in this company. I don't know. They were planning a Neville match in the main event even though he wasn't there. When they realized he wasn't going to be there, plans changed. Now, Johnson says that Neville has requested a release from his contract. And this is interesting. He says one of the factors, this is not the only reason, but one of the reasons he's been unhappy stems from being left off the WrestleMania 33 DVD, which meant that he got no royalties from his kickoff match against Austin Aries. And I told you, I talked about this months ago here on this podcast, did I not? And I had people at the time saying, what's the big deal? You're making such a big deal about this. You know, so what? They got left off the DVD. It's all the same show. It's all WrestleMania. So what? So what is those guys don't get paid like everybody else does for being on the WrestleMania card. That's the so what part. That's why it matters to them. Doesn't matter to me. I'm not the one getting royalties, but it matters to them. That's why Aries went on Twitter at the time, and even he said something about it. He made some kind of snarky-ass comment about it on his Twitter page. Obviously, it bothered Neville, too. But forget that. The bigger point is, for how long now have I stressed that Neville needs to get the hell out of that cruiserweight division. I have talked like a broken freaking record. I've talked about this. He carried that division for over a year. He had a good run. And it was time to move on. And now here we are. This fucking guy is being asked to do multiple jobs to Enzo Amore, of all people. I mean, that's enough to make anybody snap. Now, you could say, well, look, he was Cruiserweight champion for a long time. He was the face of that division. I mean, hell, they had him booked to be in the main event of Monday Night Raw this week, right? So what's there for him to complain about? You could make that argument. It's not like they were, burying him on main event where you couldn't see him. He was being used. He was being featured in some way. That's true. But it's a dead end. And he knows it's a dead end. He's not stupid. Now, he hasn't tweeted, at least last I checked anyway, he hasn't tweeted, Neville has, since he mocked that horrible new t-shirt they came out with for him. You gotta go take a look. I mean, no thought or imagination at all put into it. And he was mocking it on Twitter, and that was probably 2 weeks ago now, 2.5 weeks ago. I don't think he said anything since. You know, maybe that was his breaking point. Maybe that showed him that this company really does not give a shit about him. I don't know what his breaking point was. It was either that or being asked to lose again to Enzo. Whatever it was, I don't blame him. I don't blame him. You know, I'm sure he sees guys like Cody Rhodes and Wade Barrett and Austin Aries. I saw Aries go on Twitter just a few days ago, and he made the comment that in the last, 6 weeks or 6 months or something, he's made more money doing quote-unquote bingo hall shows and indie shows than he did his last 4 months working in WWE. Great. Good for him. I don't doubt that you've got a lot of guys out there, whether they're just doing indie, taking indie bookings, or if they're working for a Ring of Honor or New Japan, and they're able to sort of double dip and work in different places, that they probably are making more money than they would if they were in WWE right now. Not the higher level guys. The higher level guys are not making more money. I just don't see how the high level guys, you know, could compete with the money that they could make in WWE. But a lot of guys are. And they're probably a lot happier, too, that they have their freedom and they can, you know, do what they want. Some of them can call their own shots. They can turn bookings down. They don't need them. You know, there's something to be said for having that level of freedom and just being happy. And I'm sure Neville sees all these guys who have left or have said, look, I'm not re-signing and I'm going to leave and go work somewhere else. I mean, this would have been unheard of 5, 10, 15 years ago. You know, WWE was always the end-all, be-all, except during the Monday Night Wars. At least then you had another place to go. Then, you know, you didn't have to stay with WWE. You can go to WCW. You don't have that now. But more and more you're hearing about these people that are saying, you know, who grew up wrestling fans, always wanting to work for WWE, who said, you know what, I'm just not happy. I'm getting the hell out of here. And I'll be okay. I'll make decent money or really good money somewhere else. And with Aries, I mean, there were other factors, it seems like, at play with Aries. Supposedly, some people, he wasn't that well-liked. But it sounded like Aries wanted out of there as well. So I lump him into that same category of guys who just sort of gave up and left WWE to go do their own thing. But, you know, he knows he can clean up nicely on the independent scene. Does anybody doubt that this guy, if he does get his release and he can go work wherever he wants, does anybody doubt that he's not going to make good money for at least a while? I'm sure he'll make pretty good money. Yeah, he will. And he knows it. He can clean up nicely. He can go back to Japan. He can go to New Japan if he wants to. He could pretty much do anything he wants. He could have the freedom to call his own shots, make a good living. I say good for him. Now, I will say I will be pretty bummed if he leaves and then Ricochet comes in, because I do think Ricochet is going to end up in WWE or NXT or whatever early next year. I think once the Lucha Underground commitments or clauses or whatever run out, I think that's where he's going to land. And I think it was actually Neville's match against Ricochet that got him a contract with WWE in the first place. I just imagine those two working a cruiserweight program together, or even a non-cruiserweight program together. It'd be amazing. And now it looks like Neville's probably leaving just as Ricochet is about to come in. It's kind of like Nakamura coming to WWE just as Daniel Bryan is forced into an early retirement. Nakamura has said one of the reasons he even came to WWE in the first place was to work specifically with Daniel Bryan. And instead, this poor fucking guy gets Jinder Mahal. It's like a kid opening a birthday gift expecting an Xbox and he gets clothes. So we'll see what happens with Neville. He hasn't spoken. We don't know all the details, but just because he wants out doesn't mean WWE is going to let him out. Maybe they'll smooth things over. But I've been saying for months now, this guy has done all he can do in the cruiserweight division. WWE gave him a chance to run as a heel, as the champion. So I want to be fair to them here. It's not like they didn't do anything with the guy. But if Finn Balor is considered a heavyweight and can wrestle Bray Wyatt and Seth Rollins and Brock Lesnar, then there's no reason that Neville can't wrestle guys like Seth Rollins and The Miz and Jason Jordan. And now, because he's pigeonholed as a cruiserweight, they're about to lose a really talented guy. Neville isn't the only one who may be gone from WWE. We know one person who is gone, and that is Jimmy Jacobs. After 2.5 years working in creative for WWE, the former Ring of Honor star came out this week, was let go by the company, seemingly after taking a selfie with his friends from Bullet Club outside Raw a few weeks ago, and they staged their little invasion, posted the photo on Instagram, which it seemed like was the final straw for him. It got him a ton of heat. Apparently he was released a week earlier, and the news only came out this week, and as soon as it did, Jacobs released a new shirt. It was like clockwork. As soon as the news went public on Pro Wrestling Tees, a new shirt came out for him that has the offending photo on it and a newspaper headline that says unprofessional. So that's his new shirt. We knew that WWE was not happy about their mock invasion when the Young Bucks got served with that cease and desist the very next day. I mean, it was patently obvious that WWE was not happy about that. But I don't think anybody realized just how furious they really were about that whole thing. Jimmy Jacobs, by all accounts, was very well liked. We've heard people like Chris Jericho and Kevin Owens publicly on podcasts and stuff say great things about him. Chris Jericho credits him with coming up with the list idea, which made Jericho a ton of money last year. I'd like to think it was more than just a stupid Instagram photo that got the guy fired. I know PW Insider claims they talked to some sources in the company that said the photo gave them a reason to get rid of him, but that he took some time off, I guess, over the summer to deal with a personal issue of some kind, and so he may have already been in their crosshairs because of that. I don't know what that personal issue may have been, hence why it's personal. But I have yet to hear any other explanation for why this guy would have been fired. I have not read anything about him being disliked, about him doing things that he shouldn't have been doing or saying behind the company's back, or having a drug problem, or being, having a behavior issue or anything like that. It all comes down to this photo, and Jacobs himself now is making fun of the whole situation with that new shirt. Everybody, all of his friends and everybody who have commented about it seem to think that it's just a shitty thing to have happen to him over a photo. So it seems to all come down to the photo thing. Now, he obviously, the Young Bucks sent a funny tweet to Daniel Bryan asking him to take a photo with them. So they're just kind of making fun of the whole thing. I have to think that there's something else going on here, that this was sort of what pushed them over the edge. But, I mean, look, it's not as though they haven't done petty things before, right? I mean, this is the same company that punished Triple H, right, for the curtain call incident, because four guys hugged in the middle of the ring at a live event that didn't even air on TV, and they felt, well, we have to punish somebody for this horrendous atrocity here. And so they take away the guy's King of the Ring win that he was supposed to get that year, and then they bury him 6 feet under for 6 months. So again, and that's just one example. I'm sure if you guys can come up with other examples of petty things they've done before. But if the guy was well liked and he did contribute some good ideas, I think it's beyond idiotic to fire somebody for posting a photo with his friends on Instagram. I just think that's incredibly stupid. I mean, it almost, to me, and I haven't heard anybody else say this, but to me it almost reeks of them trying to spite the Young Bucks more than anything else. Maybe this had more to do with them than Jimmy Jacobs himself, which makes it even shittier if that's the case. It's like how Eric Bischoff fired Sean Waltman as a way to spite Kevin Nash and Scott Hall in WCW. Hall and Nash, they were all having disagreements with Bischoff about money or something, and just being very difficult to work with, and out of spite, he took it out on Waltman and fired him at one point. You know, I mean, so maybe, who knows, maybe Jimmy Jacobs is just a pawn in some sick revenge game that WWE is playing here because they were really pissed off by what happened a few weeks ago. I mean, to me, if you're upset that one of your employees was fooling around with friends on work time, then find the guy. Find him an undisclosed amount of money. Suspend him. To fire the guy as a way to make an example out of him is just beyond petty. I'm curious to see if more comes out about this. I want to believe there's more to it than that, but I can't say I would be shocked if it really does just turn out to be exactly what it looks like over a stupid photo. I gotta say, you know, this Young Bucks versus WWE feud is far more entertaining than Nakamura and Jinder Mahal has been. I'd say if Jimmy Jacobs had anything to do with the booking of that program, that would be a reason to fire the guy. Then you can fire him. I certainly hope he has not had a hand in that storyline on SmackDown. Dana White was in the news this week for shooting down some Conor McGregor WWE rumors. I wanted to bring this up. There was a story that originated in the Sun newspaper over in the UK, which, as one of our listeners, Chris, pointed out to me, he wrote me an email to warn me. Like the day the story ran, I literally just got done reading it, and then I got an email from him saying, "Hey, I don't know if you saw this story yet, but I wanted to give you a heads up." And he said, "Look, the Sun is highly unreliable. It is a notoriously unreliable newspaper that just has a reputation for printing total lies." And in this case, anyway, it turns out that he was right. Conor McGregor is not wrestling at WrestleMania 34. WWE denied it. Now Dana White has come out and he shot the story down. He was actually on a morning TV show here in New York this week. And he said, "Look, it's absolutely not true. It's just unequivocally 100% not true." He had just been texting that morning with Vince McMahon about it. Before he came on the show, and he mentioned that to the hosts, and the hosts didn't believe him. They're like, "I want to see the text message." He's like, "You don't believe me? Fine." So he has somebody off camera go fetch him his cell phone, and he's live on the air. He's thumbing through his text messages, and he shows them. He's like, "Here's the text, between me and Vince," because he said, "I sent Vince a text about this thing," and Vince wrote back and said, "That's news to me." And Vince also apparently said Conor McGregor appearing in WWE may be a good idea someday, but not now. He also texted that to Dana White. So I just wanted to mention that and squash this here before I start getting emails asking me, "Oh, how are they going to book Conor at WrestleMania next year?" They're not. And apparently, if the Sun breaks the story, the rule of thumb is don't believe it. Raw was live from Indianapolis last Monday, and if it was Indianapolis, you know what that means. The Shield reunion, because that's apparently the Shield's favorite city. Raw Twitter poll, 2,200 votes, 66% thumbs up, 34% thumbs down. The Shield is back. It is a shield to protect Roman Reigns. I liked it. I thought it was well done, aside from the fact that when the three of them came back out later in the show, they were already wearing their new shirts. Like, it took this company how many months to get Randy Orton his first RKO out of nowhere shirt after that whole craze went viral? A little late to the party for poor Randy Orton. These three nod at each other at the end of the show last week, and they already have a new shirt made ready to go for the following week. But I thought it was clever having Roman come out early on to confront Miz and Sheamus and Cesaro, and Miz makes this comment about, you know, there's been rumors of a Shield reunion, and Roman just goes, "Who said anything about rumors?" And out comes Rollins and Ambrose. I thought that was well done. Then they clean house and they lay Miz out with the triple power bomb like old times. They give the big fist bump at the end. People cheered. So for anybody wondering how they were going to react to Roman being out there with those guys, at least on night one, they cheered all of them in unison. There were no boos for Roman Reigns, at least not during that segment. There actually were some boos later on. There was a very quick backstage thing where they cut a very quick promo and Roman did get booed there, but it's pretty transparent what they're doing here. I mean, they're using nostalgia. They're using Seth Rollins, who is popular. They're using Dean Ambrose, who is popular, to get Roman cheered. And you know what? It worked. As long as everybody understands why they're doing this, I don't have a problem with them doing it. It worked. They got what they wanted. Say what you want, but it worked. And now when this Shield stuff runs its course in a few months, they're going to go right back to booing him, right? It's the old Band-Aid on the gunshot wound. I hope they realize that. I hope they're not foolish enough to think that by keeping these guys together for a few months, that when WrestleMania rolls around, all of a sudden everybody's going to love this guy and cheer this guy, because that will not happen. But for now, they can make their money off selling new shirts, and hopefully we get some fun matches out of it. I still don't think those three honestly get enough credit for carrying this show all the way through 2013 and a lot of 2014. It was them and Daniel Bryan. Those guys were the lifeblood of Monday Night Raw. You take those guys away, and this show would have been total garbage. Total garbage. Those Shield six-man tags were mostly fantastic. Their matches with the Wyatt family were tremendous. Another reason why I wish they would have just shifted Harper and Rowan back to Raw to align with Bray. I mean, think about it. Like, had they played their cards right, the timing would have been perfect. Look at what they're doing now. Had they played their cards right, it could have been the Shield, the reunited Shield, against the reunited Wyatt family in War Games at Survivor Series this year, instead of NXT doing the match. The Shield came back out later in the show. They ganged up on Braun Strowman. Poor Braun, they laid him out with a triple powerbomb through the announce table, and he sort of rolled off the stage. Now, granted, it's like a two-foot drop now on that Raw stage. It's not like it used to be. But they put him through the table. Look, their first night back as a unit, they needed to make a statement. They did that. Now it's on to TLC to face Miz, Strowman, Sheamus, and Cesaro in a handicap TLC match. The Shield's very first match, if you remember, on the main roster, was a TLC match. I was at that show. I think that might have even been my match of the year in 2012. I'm hoping they go all the way with this at the pay-per-view, and we get the original theme song, we get the old Riot gear for Rollins and Ambrose, the old entrance through the crowd. It'll be interesting to see if they make it winner-take-all and the titles get added to the match on TV this week. You don't have to have any titles on the line, even though it's technically, you know, a ladder match. You don't need to have championships hanging above the ring. But, you know, in this one match on the pay-per-view, you've got your Intercontinental Champion and you've got your Tag Team Champions. And we know there's not going to be a Universal title defense, so that leaves the Women's title and the Cruiserweight title as the only titles to be defended on the show. I mean, the TLC match itself is going to sell the show on its own, I guess, but me personally, I would rather they not make it winner-take-all, because the Shield should not be losing this match, I don't think, and I don't need to see Roman Reigns as the Intercontinental Champion. Tomorrow night, it's going to be Reigns against Braun Strowman in a steel cage match. We just had Strowman and Big Show in a steel cage match not all that long ago. We just had two Hell in a Cell matches last weekend. We've got War Games next month at TakeOver, with one giant cage. And now this. This company has gone cage crazy. Speaking of Roman, he ruffled some feathers this week with comments that he made on the Inside the Ropes podcast. He upset. And by the way, what are these podcasts that guys like Roman Reigns are going on? I thought they weren't doing podcasts, or they were only doing Sam Roberts' show. Send him on this way. But he upset a lot of people who felt that he was taking shots at the Young Bucks and the Bullet Club when he said this. He just got done in this interview. He had just got done praising Braun Strowman and how quickly that Strowman has progressed. And Roman had a lot to do with that. I don't know that people give him enough credit either, because as good as Braun Strowman has become compared to, let's say, where he was a year or two ago, I mean, I think the person most instrumental in that is Roman Reigns and all those matches they had and working all the house shows, which they're still doing. They're still working house show matches together. So Roman deserves a lot of credit for that. But he just got done praising Braun, and then he said this. He said, and that's what we need. Guys who, and no offense to any of these guys, but we don't need guys running around doing two sweets, and we don't need guys acting like they are DX from 15 years ago. We need original characters, guys who are them. I need Seth Rollins to be Seth Rollins. We need Kevin Owens to be Kevin Owens. We need Bray Wyatt to be Bray Wyatt. We need original superstars who have no clue what was done 15 to 20 years ago, and no disrespect for the history in our past, but we're trying to create something new here, and that's the most important thing, that we are true to our characters, we are true to our originality, and we are going forward as a product. So that's what Roman Reigns said. Now, first of all, when you feel compelled to say no disrespect before you say something, okay, more often than not, yes, you do. That's exactly what you're doing. You're better off just being honest than just saying your piece, right? It's like when somebody goes, no offense, but, it's like, no, you're not going to pull that no offense, but shit on me, okay? Like, give me a break. That being said, I'm going to stick up for Roman here. I agree with him. I agree with what he said. He's not wrong. Look, I like the Young Bucks. I respect the fact that they've taken those old gimmicks and they've made money off of them. They've kind of turned them into their own in a way. They sell a shitload of t-shirts, and I thought it was genius what they were doing when they got served with that cease and desist. I thought they made the right move by sort of mocking it and coming out with new merch, which they're now selling a lot of that. They're very smart. The Young Bucks are a lot smarter than some people give them credit for. And they've incorporated those old gimmicks, like I said, into their own characters. The whole Too Sweet thing is a fun thing to do. Finn Balor, I think, still does it. But what he's saying makes a lot of sense. Like, thank God we had someone like Stone Cold Steve Austin come along when he did. There was nobody doing what he did in WWE before he did it. Like, the beer drinking, maybe. That was Sandman and ECW. That's probably where he got it from. But Austin, you know, was an original, right? There was nobody saying and doing the things that he was saying and doing on TV at that time. I just got lost in one of those YouTube black holes the other day. Like, when you're watching something and you see a video recommended in the sidebar for, like, an old Attitude Era segment with Austin and McMahon, and you click on it, and then 45 minutes later, I'm sitting there, I just watched 7 Stone Cold videos that I had no intention of watching. It's like, and shout out to the Attitude Pop channel on YouTube, by the way, they got some great clips over there. It's all Stone Cold stuff, it's awesome. So anyway, I was reminded, as I'm sitting there watching that stuff, how freaking awesome Stone Cold was, and how there is not anybody within 50 miles on the roster today of being as over as that guy was. There is nobody who can touch him on that roster today. It's almost sickening how much more fun and exciting and energetic those shows were to watch than the ones today. I mean, it really opened my eyes when I'm watching that stuff. I'm like, I'm getting lost in this. I'm getting goosebumps watching this stuff. And I'm thinking, when was the last time I had goosebumps watching anything on WWE television? It's been a while. It's been a while. My point is, what he was doing was fun and exciting and different than anything we had seen before. He wasn't copying Hulk Hogan. He wasn't trying to be the next Randy Savage or Bruno Sammartino. Like, Austin, Rock, Triple H, Mankind, all those guys were originals. Imagine if all those guys did was try to be the next Bret Hart or Shawn Michaels. Or some other guy from 5 or 10 years earlier. Or if all WWE did was trot out the legends. Like, we see them do that all the time now. How many legend segments have we seen and the nostalgia stuff have we seen over the last 10 or 15 years? And I like it because I grew up watching a lot of those guys. But I can't imagine if I was 8 years old, 10 years old, you know, 13 years old, watching WWF at the time, if they spent half their time trotting out Bruno Sammartino and the Iron Sheik and Bob Backlund and all those guys, right? Like, I would have turned the show off. I would have been like, I don't want to watch this crap. I want to see the new guys. Like, I can't, in my brain, I can't reconcile them doing that back then. They created new guys and they got those guys over. Why, you know, why must they rely so heavily? I used to wonder, like, I would watch the legend stuff and I would think to myself, why do they feel the need to rely so heavily on that now? Yeah, obviously there's a lot of reasons for that. But just imagine that, though. If back then, those guys from the late 90s were just trying to copy and emulate people from 5, 10 years earlier. They need guys to be themselves. They need guys to get their own shit over, which isn't working out as well as it did for those other guys, but that might have more to do with the writing than anything else. Yeah, I saw Matt Jackson from the Young Bucks. He tweeted out that he was disappointed by what Roman said, and you can expect to be buried by old-timers, but not current young top guys that you respect. He took a shot at them for sure. I mean, there's no doubt about it. He can say whatever he wants about no offense and I don't mean anything by it. Yes, you do. Like, cut the shit. Yes, you do. He clearly took a shot at them, but I don't think he's wrong in what he said. I think his mind was in the right place. Maybe he's not the best messenger, I know he's supposed to be the face of the franchise and the locker room leader and all that. Maybe somebody else should have been the one to say it. Because it is funny that after what I just got done talking about last week, about how Rollins and Ambrose have both evolved somewhat kind of on their own since the Shield split up, right? And Roman Reigns is the only one still wearing a flak jacket and coming out to an updated version of his old theme song. Roman is the one guy from the Shield who hasn't really changed at all. And the other two guys at least have changed somewhat, right? New attire or new music, whatever it may be. So maybe he should take some of his own advice and go to the company and ask them to have some new music made for him or something. Maybe he wasn't the right person to say that, but that doesn't mean he's wrong. We pretty much got our confirmation this week that Sister Abigail will be Bray Wyatt in drag at TLC. All right, maybe not in drag, at least I hope not. But he will be portraying Sister Abigail. I don't know if that means he'll be wearing a veil over his head or what. He should wear a veil over his head. It'd be a great metaphor for his career so far. Finn was in the ring. He was talking. Bray popped up on the Titantron. They used some visual effects to show him morphing into Sister Abigail. They ran his voice through some sort of modulator to make him sound either like a female or like he had just inhaled a shit ton of helium. He spoke as Sister Abigail. They talked about her sweet, innocent Bray. They blatantly copied from Norman Bates and Psycho with the whole, you know, he wouldn't even harm a fly line, right? They weren't even trying to hide it. I thought it was a nice little nod to one of the all-time great horror films here as we approach Halloween. This angle is really scary, but for all the wrong reasons. I'm really dreading what they're going to do at TLC. I just feel like this is going to be a disaster. And I just really can't wait for this to be over with already. They had a Fatal 5-Way, because God knows we don't have enough of those on this show, to determine who would die at the hands of Asuka at TLC. I don't know what the hell was going on here during this match. Booker T was on commentary, rambling on about Mike Tyson and Mike Tyson and Buster Douglas in Japan, and it just wasn't making any sense. Cole and Graves were mocking him for it. And then Michael Cole tells us the match is traditional Fatal 5-Way rules. I love the idea, by the way, that Fatal 5-Ways are now a tradition in some way. He says it's one fall to a finish, and then literally 90 seconds later, if that, Bayley pins Dana Brooke with the belly to Bayley, and he realizes, oh shit, it's an elimination match, and he has to apologize for getting the rules mixed up. Just what a shit show this was. Emma rolled up Alicia Fox for the pin, so Emma meets her maker next Sunday at TLC. She was actually one of Asuka's first opponents in NXT. They had a pretty good match, as I recall. I think it was, they had like a London takeover. It might have been that show. But I have no hope that they're going to have that same kind of match at TLC. I expect it to be Squash City all the way. One thing I think they deserve a lot of praise for, now she hasn't debuted yet, right? There's still time for them to screw this up, but they've done a really good job of hyping up Asuka's debut like a really big deal. I've loved these videos that they've done, these teasers, they're really well done. They've got something with her and that undefeated streak, carrying that over from NXT. I'm telling you, don't squander this. Do not squander this. You've got something with this woman. She could be a real attraction here on the show. Don't fuck this up. And then we had Kalisto in the main event, beating Enzo Amore in a lumberjack match to win the Cruiserweight Championship. Far be it from me to sit here and complain about them taking the title off of Enzo after I complained about them putting it on him in the first place. I said at the time, you know, I thought that would be the death blow for the Cruiserweight division. And then they turned him heel, and I kind of saw, oh, they're going to go in this direction with him. And I was intrigued, and I said, you know what? This could actually work. Now, I do think that, it turned out to be a death blow. It turned out to be a death blow for Neville in WWE. The final straw, it looks like, for him. But I thought, okay, you know what? Heel Enzo, this could work. This could work. And then they took the title off him here. Now, I don't really care. He's going to get it back on Sunday. There was a scary spot where he gave Enzo a suplex off the top rope out to the floor. They fell backwards out to the floor. The Lumberjacks were there to catch them, but still, that looked scary as hell. He won with the Salida del Sol. Crowd popped for the title change. It was a feel-good moment, but like I said, that feeling ain't gonna last much longer than a week. So I hope he enjoys it. Takes all the pictures he wants to take. Enzo's getting that belt back. They were put in a tough spot with Neville not being there, having to rewrite things. They made the best of a bad situation. Aside from the Shield stuff, I didn't care really about anything on this show. I didn't think it was really all that exciting or interesting of a show, but the Shield stuff for me saved it. SmackDown was live from Grand Rapids, Michigan last week. 1,700 votes in the poll. 69% thumbs up, 31% thumbs down. There was no Maharaja on this show, but he will be at Survivor Series. And as a matter of fact, we now know the planned main event. Or one of the main events, anyway, because if there's anybody with half a functioning brain in that company, this will not headline the show. But according to Dave Meltzer, the current plan for Survivor Series is to have WWE Champion Jinder Mahal take on the Universal Champion Brock Lesnar in a non-title Raw versus SmackDown match, a match where neither one of their championships are on the line. Not that that would make it any better, although I guess it could if Brock beat him and then just unified the two things. I'd be okay with that. But it's a non-title match. Like I said on Twitter, NXT gives us war games, Survivor Series gives us bore games. Is that not a recipe for disaster or what? I mean, Brock Lesnar gets shit on by so many people because he's boring, he blows up, he gets gassed 2 minutes into matches, all he does is suplex, he doesn't know how to wrestle anymore. And I wish that we would get some of that old Brock Lesnar back. I don't even know if that Brock Lesnar exists anymore. Maybe he doesn't. He's 40 years old. I don't know if I think he's in there somewhere. He could probably wrestle a real match if he wanted to, but I agree. It gets tiresome, but I still like Brock. The thing about Brock is, with the right opponent, Brock goes out there and has good, fun matches. Without the right opponent, it's a disaster. And it's a giant bore. But he's got to be in there with the right opponent. Jinder Mahal is not that opponent. And if they think, well, it doesn't matter because it's going to be a big attraction. It's Raw champion against SmackDown champion. Yeah, but look who the champions are. Like, Brock is the Universal champion. Brock is still an attraction. He's still a big deal. Fine. Jinder Mahal, he's nowhere near that level. So there's got to be more to it than just, well, it's a big match because we said so. That's not how this works. Just because you put an R next to one guy and an S next to the other guy, like it's some big interpromotional match. I mean, you haven't been doing the brand split for that long where we're just going to, you know, see a Raw versus SmackDown match and think, wow, what a big deal. Not the case. This is a no-win situation. Either Brock dominates him and wins, which you can do since the title's not on the line, and they bury SmackDown in the process. And then what the fuck was the point of Nakamura losing two pay-per-view matches to this guy? Or they can have Jinder win. And if they have Jinder Mahal do what Samoa Joe and Braun Strowman and even Roman Reigns, the mighty Roman Reigns, couldn't do, and I don't care if somebody interferes in the match and that's what caused Brock the match or not, if that's what they do, then the old man has truly checked into Crazy Town USA. Population one. Now, some of you wrote into me and said, well, what about a Survivor Series match? What if they do Team Lesnar against Team Jinder? That could work. I'd be okay with that. Because then you could also do something in that match where it helps sort of set up the next two challengers for each title. Like, that match could serve a purpose. And I actually remember the Survivor Series match they did, Raw vs. SmackDown, back in 03. I think it was Team Orton against Team Bischoff, or I think Shawn Michaels was the last guy in there. Oh no, it was Team Austin against Team Bischoff, I think. And maybe that wasn't even a Raw vs. SmackDown match now that I think about it, but that was an awesome Survivor Series match. Anyway, the point is, you could do that. I'd be okay with that. But as a singles match, I agree with a lot of you guys. The only potentially enjoyable aspect of this would be seeing Brock Lesnar cripple the Bollywood Boys. That's about it. That could be fun to watch. Like, if Randy Orton nearly killed those two guys, imagine what Brock Lesnar could do to them. So, but once you get past that, it's all downhill. There are no good outcomes here. I don't know what they're thinking with this, but it is a terrible idea. I poked fun at there being another multi-person match on Raw. the Fatal 5-Way. So naturally, not to be outdone, they have Daniel Bryan come out and announce a Fatal 4-Way here for the to determine the next challengers for the SmackDown Tag Team titles. It was Chad Gable and Shelton Benjamin beating out the Hype Bros, the Ascension, and Breezango. So Gable and Benjamin are going to get the next shot against the Usos, which is great. I like Chad Gable, and I want to see him do well, and I think that'll be a good match. No Pulp Fashion this week. Remember on the pay-per-view, they kind of teased the next installment of the Fashion Files was going to follow the old Pulp Fiction. I don't know if it's going to be in the same vein as the movie Pulp Fiction or what. They were going to call it Pulp Faction or Pulp Faction. I don't even know what I'm saying anymore. Pulp Fiction was going to be mocked here, I guess, as Pulp Fashion. And they were going to have a segment on SmackDown. And then there was no segment. I don't even know if they mentioned it. It's like a running joke at this point. They promise stuff with these guys, the next installment, the next day, and then they don't do it. It's amazing. Kevin Owens. Let's talk about the main story here on this show, which is Kevin Owens coming out and introducing his best friend and guardian angel, Sami Zayn. Sami Zayn comes out after giving Owens the assist at Hell in a Cell, and he comes out to his old music, right? Everything is the same. He's got a nice shit-eating grin on his face. He looks like a happy guy. And he comes out, he's getting booed. First time we've really seen Sami Zayn get booed. They give him the mic. And it's a love fest, really, at that point. He says his eyes were opened up when he got powerbombed on the apron by Kevin Owens a couple of weeks ago. And he said, look, I've always tried to please people and make people happy, but look what it's gotten me. Meanwhile, look at Kevin Owens. He's been the Intercontinental Champion, the U.S. Champion, the Universal Champion, just like he said. And you know, Sami said, look, I came to SmackDown. Shane McMahon brought me to this show, told me I'd get the respect that I deserved and I'd get opportunities. And that was the last meeting that Shane ever had with me. And I kept doing my job and I had a smile on my face. But when I tried to warn Shane about Kevin Owens, now remember that segment from SmackDown the week before the pay-per-view, where Shane was just a man possessed, and Sami tried to calm him down and talk some sense into him, and Shane basically cast the guy off like he was nothing. So that factored into the story here. And Sami says, when I got brushed off by Shane, that's when I realized Shane doesn't care about me. When he was at Hell in a Cell, he had the match won, and he decided to climb back up to the top of the cell to kill Kevin Owens. He didn't care about Kevin Owens. He doesn't care about anybody but himself. And that's when he had his Eureka moment. He rescued Kevin. And he said that Owens was right the entire time. And he thanked him. And they both raised each other's hands over and over again in a really cheesy way. Like you thought you thought they were going to turn on each other or something. I liked this. I liked Sammy's explanation of things because it's not him coming out and being like, you people suck. You people turned your back on me. I'm a bad guy now. Boo me. You know, he came out and he said, look, I tried. I was made promises, I tried to be the good guy here, and I got shit on, it didn't get me anywhere. Kevin Owens, who's the biggest jerk in the world, has won all these championships and had all this success, he's in pay-per-view main events. Yeah, right, that's basically what the story is here. And then he said, and now I see that Shane doesn't give a fuck about me, and I see who my brother really is. So I like that. I like that. And I'm going to enjoy watching the two of them work together because We're so used to seeing them against each other, to the point where even I was tired of it. It's like, all right, we've seen enough of Kevin Owens against Sami Zayn. This is the first time we're going to get to see Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn together, at least in WWE. Obviously, we've seen them together outside the company, but the only time they ever, you know, hugged and were friends was the night that Kevin Owens debuted, and before that show was even over, he laid Sami out. So this is something fresh. This is something new. And what I like about it is the fact that it gets Sami Zayn involved in a main event storyline here on this show. And I cannot understand for the life of me. And I saw some of this in our Facebook group. I saw some of this on Twitter. Like, there are people complaining, oh, stupid WWE, turn Sami Zayn heel. What a dumb move. Are you kidding me? Like, if you're a Sami Zayn fan, if you want to see the guy do well, if you want to see the guy featured on TV, how the fuck could you have a problem with them turning him heel and putting him in the storyline? What has Sami Zayn been doing all year? He has been doing nothing. He has been doing dick all year long. He was a stepping stone for Jinder Mahal to win a battle royal and become champion. Jinder Mahal. Meanwhile, Sami Zayn is stuck wrestling Mike Kanellis and people like that and doing nothing. Now, all of a sudden, he's out there during a pay-per-view main event. He's factored prominently into the finish. He comes out, he cuts this great promo here on the show. We're going to get to see him now on TV every week doing main events and stuff. And people complain about that who are supposedly fans of Sami Zayn. I don't get that. I don't understand that. I mean, yes, Sami, I thought Sami was a great babyface. And I thought he was the closest thing to a Daniel Bryan type. He wasn't getting Daniel Bryan reactions. There's nobody in this company getting the kind of reactions that Bryan was getting in 2014. There's nobody that comes close. I mean, Bryan was the first and only guy I could think of since the Attitude Era who was getting the kind of pops and reactions that guys like Austin and Rock were getting. Now, it wasn't translating necessarily into business. I don't want to sit here and say Daniel Bryan was selling out buildings and he was the top merch seller and all that. I'm just talking in terms of pure, raw crowd reactions. I had not seen anything like that since The Rock and Steve Austin. That was the closest we came. And Sami Zayn is not in that same league. We've not seen him get those types of reactions. But in terms of, I think, the kind of sympathetic babyface who's you want to root for and you want to see him do well, he's a lot like Bryan in that way. So yeah, I get where you would think, man, why would you take a guy like that and turn him? But in this situation, they weren't doing anything with him. It wasn't doing him any good. He could be the best babyface in the world. What does it matter if they're not featuring him? A spot opened up for him to be a heel. If you're a fan of the guy's work, you should be happy. You should be ecstatic. You should be over the moon right now. Plus, I don't think this is going to last very long. I think he's going to go back babyface within 6 months anyway. So calm down and just enjoy it because you don't know how long it's going to last for. I'm happy to see the guy featured prominent. It's about time. It's about time. This is long overdue. We had a video with Luke Harper and Eric Rowan. We haven't seen them on TV in months. In fact, I think the last time we saw them, they were wrestling each other. They were feuding. All of a sudden, they're back together. They're calling themselves the Bludgeon Brothers. They have these giant, like, Thor-like hammers, and they're spitting out rhymes. Whatever. Like, We figured they were coming back as a team. They can call themselves whatever they want to. SmackDown needs teams. They're a new team. I'm glad to see at least Harper back. I've never been a big Rowan fan, but I like Luke Harper. I'm happy to see him back. I still think they're making a giant mistake by not putting them back with Bray on Raw. I still say that, but it's at least good for them to have a new team on TV in the mix. We had Bobby Roode and Dolph Ziggler. This was a freaking disaster. So let me talk about this. So Bobby Roode and Dolph Ziggler had a match at Hell in a Cell. It was boring, it was bland, it was very basic. There was nothing special or fun about it at all. And I'm sure the positioning of it on the show right before the main event didn't help. But you could put that match anywhere on the card. I think that match was going to die a death no matter what. They had Bobby Roode win with a roll-up and then Dolph laid him out. It was obvious that this feud was going to continue. So Bobby Roode comes out for a promo. And he's talking about how Sunday was such a glorious day and, you know, until Dolph decided to attack him from behind and he challenged Dolph and Ziggler came out and they're jaw-jacking back and forth. And somewhere in here, what I think happened is Bobby Roode forgot his lines. And if this were SmackDown back in the day, they could edit this out of the show, they could fix it in post-production, but it's live now, so you can't do that. So Bobby Roode lost his train of thought or he forgot his lines, whatever it was. And he's standing there and not saying anything. He's got this very awkward smile on his face. It's dead silent. And I'm just watching this and I'm like, I'm cringing when I'm watching them. Like, for God's sakes, say something, you know, like improvise something for God's sakes. This was terrible. And then finally, the whole point of this was they set up a Roode Ziggler match for TV the following week, right? When the announcement was made, right? The whole climax of this, you could hear a pin drop. You could hear somebody break wind in the frickin' nosebleed section. That's how quiet it was in the building for this. And I just got done talking about this on Sunday. 2 days before this, I was ranting again about this during my Hell in a Cell review. about how Bobby Roode needs to be a heel. There was absolutely no reason to change from what he was doing in NXT when he got called up. The only reason I could think of is they needed a babyface, so let's make him a babyface. We got to have, you know, try to have an even Steven, alignment here of heels to faces. Otherwise, I don't know why you would do this. He's not even that good of a babyface. He's so awkward. And you're taking away all the stuff that's funny and you know, makes him interesting and makes him such a prick because he's so good at it. That's why he was so good in NXT. I enjoyed his work in NXT. He wasn't out there having necessarily the best matches on the card. But heel Bobby Roode? I mean, you guys know, if you've been listening to this podcast for any length of time, when I was still watching Impact full-time, whatever, 2012, 2013, like during that period, one of my favorite acts from Impact every week was the Dirty Heels. It was Bobby Roode and Austin Aries when they formed their tag team. I love the shit out of those guys. I was a big fan of Bobby Roode's work. So, you know, when he came over to WWE and he was doing the heel thing again, big fan of his work. He comes to SmackDown, he's a babyface. And then I see something like this and I'm like, how did we get to this point? Who thought this would be a good idea to turn this guy? This is not who he is. He is dying a death out there. You know, Dolph was making fun of him a few weeks ago. All you are is an entrance. That's all you are, right? I hate to say it. He's not wrong. Right now, that's all he is. Right now, all Bobby Roode is on this show is an entrance. He's an entrance and a theme song. That's it. Now, I would not have said that about him in NXT. I would say that about him now. And until I think they turn him heel, that's all he's going to be. But this was painful to watch. I mean, I know guys, look, they make mistakes, they forget things, but he just never should have been in that position in the first place. There was no reason to change from what he was doing in NXT. Main event on this show is Baron Corbin defending his United States Championship against AJ Styles. They had a good match. Corbin won clean. He won clean in the end with the End of Days. Hit his move, got the pin. Again, doesn't bother me because my hope is that AJ is moving on to something else. Somebody emailed me and floated the idea of maybe a Team Shane against Team Owens or something at Survivor Series, and you can have AJ, you know, linking up with Shane against Owens and Sammy, and then somehow you flesh those teams out. I'm all in on that. I think that would be a fantastic idea. Anything to get AJ away from Corbin and the U.S. title. He had his run with it. But let's kind of move on from that. And so Corbin, after the match is over, he's out there in the ring. Renee Young comes out, and all of a sudden Renee Young is interviewing him, which is kind of awkward because they're about to go off the air. And in fact, in the middle of this promo, they put the copyright box up, and they fade to black. So that was kind of weird. But Corbin's out there. He's like, oh, you fans, you can, you know, cry about it and talk crap about me. I'm going to buy a boat to float in your tears. I'm like, all right, that's kind of funny. And then they just cut away, and the show ended. So, to me, the highlight really was, I think, the follow-up to the Owens and Zayn stuff. I thought Zayn really hit the nail on the head with that promo. I'm gonna enjoy the run as long as it lasts. Because here's the thing about Owens and Sami Zayn, right? So, if you have followed the Kevin Owens character from the moment he debuted in NXT, like literally his very first night in NXT when he turned on Sami. The one thing that they have communicated to us, the one thing that you have learned about the Kevin Owens character is that he is, I don't know if sociopath is the right word to use here, but he doesn't care about your feelings. Fuck your feelings. The only person he cares about is Kevin Owens. He has no friends. Yeah, his quote-unquote friendship with Jericho, we saw how that ended. This one will probably end in similar fashion. It's all about Kevin Owens. So we already know that this is not going to last all that long, and I'm curious how it plays out. Now, somebody wrote in with a mailbag question that pitched a very interesting scenario that I really liked, and so I'm going to talk about it. You'll want to stick around for that. We'll get to that in the mailbag. But I am going to enjoy seeing how this stuff plays out, and if they do shift AJ up into the main event scene, maybe somehow forming an alliance with Shane against these two, like I said, I'm all in on that. I think that's the right position for AJ to be in. He should be more prominently featured on this show and get away from Baron Corbin. And you got other guys like Randy Orton. What are they going to do with him? I've already said swap him out for Samoa Joe. Puts a new face on the show. Joe should be back soon. Rusev, he's another guy that I'd like to see them do more with. I don't have any hope at this point, but talk about guys who are being wasted. Fucking Rusev, man. So, but the pieces are there for SmackDown. I think they just have to sort of put them in the right place, but the pieces are definitely there for this show.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
NXT, the Road to War Games, had Peyton Royce beating Liv Morgan and Nikki Cross to earn a spot in the Fatal 4-Way at TakeOver in Houston for the vacant NXT Women's Championship. The Undisputed Era showed up on stage in the middle of the match with Tainara Conti. She's the Brazilian from the Mae Young Classic. Adam Cole was encouraging her to go to the ring to do something, and that something turned out to be making sure Nikki Cross did not win this match, because I guess, you know, the Undisputed Era is currently locked in a feud with Sanity. She did ultimately cost Nikki the match. Peyton pinned Nikki with the Perfect Plex. That is an interesting pairing, putting her with Cole, Fish, and O'Reilly, if in fact she is with them. They could use a hot valet, so if she is with them, I dig that. We had the Velveteen Dream against Lio Rush. I love the fact, again, Topanga is a big Lio Rush mark, and she was on Twitter saying, oh, I just watched your match against the Velveteen Dream. I'm telling you, man, you gotta bring this woman in to be his manager, for God's sake. Let's go. Let's do it. Even if, I don't care if it's like a one-time, like, takeover thing. Like, they do these fun things at takeover sometimes. Just gotta have her out there. Like, have her, like, just, like, escort him down to the ring or something for a match. She's, like, in love with this guy. So they had it was a quick match, but they gave Lio at the beginning like the chance to show some flashy stuff off that really got over with the crowd there. So that was fun. After that, he pretty much just got beaten down. Velveteen Dream. He's on the second rope, right? He's on the second rope on the inside. He does this thing where he jumps up, right? Hands free. He jumps up onto the top rope and then comes off for the Purple Rainmaker elbow. Very impressive. So a win for the Velveteen Dream, and a good showing for Lio Rush. I didn't expect him to win, and he had a chance to shine in the first 90 seconds or so. After that, though, it was all downhill. We had Lars Sullivan beating Danny Burch. This was disappointing. I expected more out of this. I thought the Oney Lorcan match with Sullivan was a lot more fun. This was pretty straightforward stuff. We had the Street Profits winning another squash match. These two are easily the hottest act on NXT right now. How long it'll last, I don't know, but they really, I said this a few weeks ago, they've sort of taken the place of Cass and Enzo, you know, as that resident popular act on the show. And, you know, Montez Ford in particular, there's something about him. I don't know if it's the look, I don't know if, you know, from what I've seen of him in the ring, he's pretty impressive in the ring too, and has a pretty cool looking frog splash. So I think there's a lot of potential for him probably as a singles at some point down the road. But as a team, these guys were a lot of fun to watch. We've seen Angelo Dawkins. My God, how long has he been there for? He's been there for years. I mean, he's still doing that whole stir in the pot, Baker's crap. I still think he should be out there with a Baker's hat on. But he's been there for so long, it's cool to see him finally find something that works. Tyler Breeze was the same way. I mean, there's a guy that tried so many things until finally he was on his last legs and he tried that whole I'm a model type gimmick, right? And it with the phone, and it caught on. You just never know. You never know what's going to catch fire and what's going to work. And you can go through 3, 4, 5 different ideas and then finally hit on a winner. And that's what happened with this guy. Main event was a rematch from TakeOver between Johnny Gargano and Andrade Cien Almas. Really good stuff. These two work very well together. Gargano had him locked in the Gargano Escape. I wonder why it's called the Gargano Escape, right? If I had a submission move, I wouldn't call it the Escape, right? That's the last thing I want. I would come up with a different, like maybe the No Escape or something like that. But anyway, he calls it the Gargano Escape. Zelina Vega takes her jacket off to reveal an old DIY t-shirt. And she gets up on the apron and Gargano gets up in her face and says, "That doesn't matter to me anymore. I'm not going to let that distract me." He said this as he was being distracted. And Almas sent Johnny face first into the bottom turnbuckle. He followed that up with two pairs of running knees in the corner. And then the hammerlock DDT for the win. So he goes up 2-0 on Gargano. Next week it's going to be Ruby Riott, Ember Moon, and who's the other person? There's another I forgot the other person, but there's another qualifier for the Women's Championship match at TakeOver. We're going to get Sanity up against the Undisputed Era. We should be getting close to the War Games announcement. I don't know what week, maybe another 2 weeks or so it should air on TV. I'm hyped. I am hyped for that match. From what I read, they're going to be putting their own spin on the rules. I don't know what that means. I'm a little worried, but I don't get too worried when it comes. It's like Lucha Underground, right? NXT and Lucha Underground, I don't worry too much because I feel like in the end, usually they do the right thing. So I would kind of expect them to put their own spin on the rules of the match. I mean, they're going to have the two rings, which is all I need. So I'm fine with it. We'll find out what the rules are, I guess, as we get closer. I am fascinated to see how it looks. Like, WWE has never done the two-ring setup before. Everything with the product now, like on the main roster anyway, it's just, like, all the pay-per-view sets, it's so generic. Like, it's a nice change of pace to see them going out of their comfort zone, even if it is just for one night. Lucha Underground. This was week three of Ultima Lucha. This was the penultimate episode of Ultima Lucha. This episode really didn't rely as heavily on the gore as the first two episodes. But I thought it was the weakest of the three so far. I'm not saying it was bad. I enjoyed it. It was a fun show. But the first two episodes built to two big main events with stories that had been building over the course of the season. I mean, I guess you could say Taya and Sexy Star had an issue that sort of dated back a while also, but this ranks below the other two episodes for me. We did have Taya and Sexy Star in a last Luchadora standing match. Taya had a pair of brass knuckles around her neck that she carried with her to the ring. Sexy Star pulled out a pair of her own from her bra. These two came prepared, clearly, for this match. Taya should have worn an iron cast on her arm, just to be sure. Just to be safe. They brawled all over ringside. Taya bled. Third week in a row, we've had somebody busted open here on this show. Second female, too. Last week it was Eva Lise, this week it's Taya. It was Taya's turn to bleed this week after Sexy raked her face, like, across some fencing, the old cheese grater move. Sexy also then smashed a bottle over her head just like Katrina did to Eva Lise the week before. Taya sets two tables up on top of one another. She's stacking tables. She's like, she thinks she's an ECW or something. And so she stacks these two tables up on top of each other right next to where the announcers are sitting. They brawled up onto one of the camera decks. This poor camera guy. I thought he was involved, like he was going to take a bump or something, but he just looked scared out of his friggin' wits. Like, he's holding the camera, he's trying not to get in the way, he doesn't know what's going on here. I'm sure that camera probably caused more than his two children do or whatever. So they're brawling now up onto this camera deck. They fall off, they crash down through both tables, and Sexy was able to beat the 10 count and get to her feet just in time to earn the win. Fun brawl. Weird to watch, knowing the real-life issues these two had after this was taped. I would love to see the two of them in this kind of a brawl now, how that might turn out. I think it would be very interesting. Honestly, it probably wouldn't turn out that well for Taya. I mean, as much as I don't care for Sexy Star, I don't know. If I had a pick between the two of them in a real fight, I don't know that I could go with Taya. We had Drago, Pindar, and Vibora, the Reptile Tribe, defending their trios tag team titles against the Mac, Killshot, and Dante Fox. This, after the Mac won a Battle Royal the week before for a unique opportunity last week. That was last week on the show. So I think it's insane, okay, to have Killshot and Dante back wrestling on TV so soon after the match they had. Even crazier, they had Dante out there wrestling on that back. He was wearing a shirt, right? So once the shirt came off, you could see his back was torn to shreds. Oh my God, it was all scarred up. You could see the chunk of flesh that was missing from his lower back. After a few minutes, naturally, his back starts to bleed. He's bleeding all over the place. It's like, oh, more blood, by the way, on this show. So he and Killshot almost worked a little too well together, given that war that they just had a few weeks ago. But, I mean, I guess in storyline, what? They got it out of their system, right? Sometimes brothers fight, they get it out of their system, now they're cool. I mean, I never slammed my brother onto a sheet of glass or ripped his skin off, you know, but I used to fight with him a lot when we were younger and we would make up the next day, so I guess that does happen. So Dante hit the sit-down Spanish fly off the top on Pindar, followed by the kill stomp by Killshot. Mac runs over with a little mini splash for the pin. And with that, we have new Trios champions. So this was a fun match. We may never get to see these three actually defend these titles, but it was a fun match. Main event was Pentagon Dark against the Son of Havoc in what was basically, I said the Son of Havoc. I'm like Bret Hart now, the WCW. Son of Havoc in basically what turned into a tables, ladders, and chairs match. This was for the Gift of the Gods championship. Second coolest spot of the match, I thought here, was there was an RKO spot. Havoc goes up for the shooting star press. As he comes down, Pentagon gets up, catches him for the cutter on the way down. Basically the Randy Orton, Evan Bourne spot recreated here. The coolest spot, and also the most dangerous looking, but it was still cool, was Pentagon is standing on top of four chairs. Okay, so four chairs had been strategically placed next to each other. Two chairs basically facing each other. You've almost created a little chair platform here in the middle of the ring. He gave Havoc a package pile driver right onto the chairs. You can see the chairs are all bent. They're all dented. Probably a dent in his head after that. But instead of climbing up and grabbing the belt, because that would be too easy, Pentagon sets up a bunch of ladders. He sets one up in the middle. He lays another one flat across to create a ladder bridge. None of this made any sense. Why he wouldn't have just climbed up, he wasted so much time. Havoc comes back, of course. When he finally does try to climb, it's too late. Havoc stops him. Now they're standing on the ladder bridge, and they're duking it out back and forth. All of a sudden, Pentagon grabs him. He grabs him in a chokeslam position, and he slams him down through a table that was set up down below. So Son of Havoc crashes through this table. It just explodes. And that paved the way for Pentagon to climb up and to retrieve the Gift of the Gods title. So he is your new Gift of the Gods champion. This was fun. This was not at the level of the last two main events that we've had the past few weeks, but this was fun. And we ended the show with a shot of Prince Puma. He was meditating in Vampiro's dojo, I guess it would be. Vamp had makeup on that made him look like Uncle Fester if Uncle Fester just had gotten his throat slashed. He told Puma, "Our journey is almost over. It ends next week." And Puma walked off and Vampiro stepped into the circle where Puma had been sitting. And they went off the air with Vampiro thanking his master. So a little bit of a cliffhanger there. Vampiro is usually the master, right? He was Pentagon's master. He's been Puma's master. So Vampiro himself apparently has some sort of benefactor or master, some higher power that he's working for. Maybe it's the mystery boss guy that we've seen Dario Cueto meet with in that limo. Who knows? Hopefully we'll get our answer this Wednesday, because it is the fourth and final installment of Ultima Lucha. It's going to be a two-hour finale. They've got three matches. It's Matanza going up against El Dragon Azteca Jr. in a cage match. Jeremiah Crane, Mil Muertes, and they call him Cage, in a literal gauntlet match. And Johnny Mundo defends his Lucha Underground Championship against Prince Puma. If Puma loses, he is gone from Lucha Underground. Everyone may be gone from Lucha Underground if we don't hear some news real soon about a Season 4. I don't know who wins the match. I don't know. I didn't read up on who wins the match. We know Puma's gone, though, right? Puma's not coming back. Even if Lucha Underground does. So I would think it's very likely he loses this match. We've seen Johnny Mundo pop up on Impact. Although I guess that doesn't necessarily mean he's done in Lucha Underground, because there's a working agreement between Impact and AAA. I'm thinking Pentagon cashes in his Gift of the Gods and wins the championship. The only kind of problem with that, I guess, is they've made very clear on this show that with the Gift of the Gods, you've got to give a week's advance notice. It's not like Money in the Bank where you can just cash it on the spot. You go to Dario, you tell him, "I want to cash in." He says, "Okay," and then he books the match for the week after. That's the only little chink in the armor here. I'm sure they could find a way around that if they wanted to. They can make exceptions, right? I mean, this is a show where people teleport. There are people from other dimensions. There are people who fly into the cosmos. There are people who eat each other's faces off. There's always a way you can bend the rules a little bit. But if somebody goes down as the final ever Lucha Underground champion, Pentagon, I think, would be the perfect person. Plus, if they don't come back, what good is the gift of the gods? He's got a belt that he may not even be able to use. I think he needs to cash in on this last show. Mailbag time. If you have questions, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. I'm also doing an exclusive Q&A video for TV Tracks. I've done a couple of these before. It's about time I do another one. I know Tracks just put the video clip up of me making the announcement, and I've asked people who want to submit questions that they do so in the comments section under that video. So if that's something you might be interested in, you can always submit questions there, and I'll try to get to as many as I can. Let's see here. Aki from Finland. The setup for the TLC match between The Shield and Miz, Strowman, Sheamus, and Cesaro feels a little odd with it being 3-on-4. I have a feeling they will add another member to The Shield side. I'm thinking Matt Hardy, since he is tied into the whole TLC match idea, and it would give them someone who can be pinned on The Shield side for them to lose the match. In return, their win at Survivor Series would feel much bigger. What do you think? I don't think it matters. I mean, you know, if they win or lose, I think they should win. But I don't see them adding anybody. I think the story is that Miz said that Dean Ambrose said, hey, we can beat you guys 5, 6, 7, 8 up. It doesn't matter. So Miz took advantage of that. He added another guy, and we now have to see if the Shield can live up to their word and if they can win a match, where they're at a man disadvantage. So for them to suddenly turn around and add another person, it kind of kills that whole story, right? It kills the whole point of that. And, I don't know, the Shield is back, and, oh, by the way, here's Matt Hardy. Like, maybe if it was Broken Matt, it would be kind of interesting to see him teaming up with the Shield, but just Matt Hardy, you know, just so he could eat the fall? I don't like that idea. I hope they don't do that. Miguel from Malta. I was wondering what endgame the Sami Zayn Kevin Owens angle might have. The ideal way for this to blow off, in my opinion, would be for them to face each other in a WWE Championship match at WrestleMania 34. The angle should be about Owens using Zayn as he did with Jericho to get ahead, with Zayn being blinded with love for his brother. To get to the title scene, they could have Owens win the title from the person who dethrones Jinder, whether it's AJ, Nakamura, or whoever, at the Royal Rumble, via an assist from Sami Zayn, with Kevin Owens then helping Sami win the Royal Rumble match later on in the night, which in Kevin Owens' mind would render him challengerless at WrestleMania, because there's no way that Sammy would go on to challenge him for the championship. You could then do the whole will he, won't he scenario like they did with Batista in 2005, with Kevin Owens egging on Sami Zayn to cross over and challenge for the Universal title, until Zayn realizes what Owens has been doing, he's been using him, and he reveals that he will be challenging for the WWE title, culminating with Zayn winning at WrestleMania. What do you think? This is the idea that I was talking about earlier that I was pretty excited about. I like this idea. I actually like this idea a lot. I was thinking, you know, just watching what they were doing on Tuesday, like watching Sami Zayn out there yucking it up with Kevin Owens on SmackDown. I'm thinking, like, maybe this is all a ruse. Maybe it's like some kind of master plan or something. It's like when Kurt Angle, right, joined the, you know, Team WCECW, whatever the hell they were called. And he was the mole. He was the WWF mole, right? You can do these long, drawn-out scenarios where it was all just part of the plan. It was all a ruse. Or maybe he doesn't, right? Maybe they don't go that way. And he really is blinded by Owens. And a few months down the road, he comes to that realization. But like you said, what's the payoff, right? So to do just another Sami Zayn, Kevin Owens singles match at WrestleMania, let's say, with nothing on the line, I don't need to see that. It actually makes perfect sense for them to wrestle for the championship because of that promo that Owens cut on Sammy a few weeks ago when he was talking about all these different titles that I've won and you've won nothing. I was the NXT champion and Sammy was the NXT champion as well, but ever since he came to the main roster, Owens has won 3 different titles and Sammy's won nothing, right? So it should be Kevin Owens to finally that Sammy beats to finally win one. I mean, they could still do, you know, AJ Styles and Nakamura on, let's say, the undercard as a big attraction to WrestleMania. I've been pitching for AJ to win the Royal Rumble, and make that match the SmackDown title match at WrestleMania. I'm tired of the championship being featured like second or third from the top. The WWE title at this point is a friggin' joke. And I think you need that championship involved in a big-time match at WrestleMania. God knows at WrestleMania this year, the title was relegated to some, you know, to shit on that card. I mean, let's just be honest. So I'd like to see that championship contested in a big match at WrestleMania next year. And I think AJ and Nakamura in WWE for the first time would be a big match. Your idea, though, works too. And it works because you have a story tied into it that's going to play itself out, let's say, over a period of however many months, 6 months, 7 months, whatever it is. So I'm perfectly fine with either one of those ideas, but I really like the one that you pitched. Shay from Australia, do you think it would be a good idea for WWE to create a World Cup network special where they could reach out to top promotions and wrestling hotspots like Mexico, Japan, and Australia, and have their world champion and secondary title holder compete in a special tournament? It would be near impossible to do this, but I think it would be an interesting idea. Well, TNA's already done that. I think they call what they call it the X Cup. I think they may have called it, where they've had teams representing different countries competing. They've brought in people from other promotions from all over the world. So, I mean, credit to them for trying it. It's a good idea. I think for WWE to do it would be impractical. There's too many egos involved. And unless they've developed a working relationship with every single one of those promotions, I don't see what sense there is in them featuring other people's talent on their network. I just don't. I mean, I would rather see some kind of WWE versus NXT special, like they listed in that survey they did a few weeks ago. Maybe not a tournament, but like a one-night-only type deal. At least then you're working with talent that belongs to you, that you have under contract, that you could call them up afterwards. If one or two guys have a really impressive showing, you know, that's entree for them to be called up right after. I like what they've done with the Cruiserweight Classic, the UK tournament, the Mae Young Classic. I say stick to that model. Do a Japanese tournament, maybe a tag team tournament. That's what I would like to see them do. Chris, from Pensacola, Florida, home of the big dog. Is it possible we see Braun Strowman win the Royal Rumble match and then challenge Jinder Mahal for the WWE title at WrestleMania? God, I hope not. God, I hope not. Like I just said, we have not had a good WWE championship match at WrestleMania, I don't think, since 31. That was the last really good WWE title match we had at WrestleMania. I'd like to change that next year. I don't want to keep that this horrible streak alive that's been forming the last, you know, couple of years. So I hope they don't do that. Peyton from Phoenix, a few weeks ago, you were mentioning possible premium content coming to the network. What would you say about a special called Gorilla? As a wrestling fan, you always hear about the gorilla position. Do you think it would be neat to see who's there, what's being said, and how the talent is feeling when their music hits? I thought this was going to, when I first got this question, I thought this was a question about doing a Gorilla Monsoon special on the network, which I'd be down for, by the way. But yeah, I think that's a neat idea. I like that. But here's the thing, like, I would want it to have footage from behind the curtain for, like, big events from the past. Like, show me what was going on in the gorilla position when Vince called for the bell in Montreal at Survivor Series and everybody came through to the back, right? Show me guys like Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker coming back through the curtain after their WrestleMania 25 match. You know they probably have footage of, like, Daniel Bryan coming back through the gorilla position all pissed off when they called his match off that one time on Raw because he got hurt and he almost got in a fist fight. Like, he had to be separated from Triple H. I mean, I don't know where that happened. Maybe that happened in a hallway somewhere, but you gotta know they've got a lot of this shit already, you know, like, locked up in their archives. So as long as we get footage like that, I don't want to just see current stuff. Current stuff is cool and all, but I want some of that to be incorporated into there as well. Like Vince going off on people and stuff. That would be fun to watch. Mike from Tunkhannock, Pennsylvania. I've never heard of that city before. As someone who watches New Japan on occasion, I've noticed that they have many different championships. 8, I believe, at this point. Do you think that's too many? And if so, what is a good number of championships to have? Dude, I can't even keep up with how many titles they have in New Japan. Like, I know they have the IWGP title. They have the Intercontinental title. They just added their own United States title. There's a NEVER title, whatever that stands for. I think they have two sets, right, of tag team titles, like a regular set and then like a junior heavyweight set. After that, it's all a blur. I don't know what the other titles are. It's lost on me. It's too many. I honestly think the Lucha Underground model is the best model. You have one Lucha Underground champion. You have a Gift of the Gods title, which, by the way, that belt looks badass. It's a bunch of medallions. Like, they got like magnets in the belt. And like every person who wins a medallion in the qualifying matches to the Gift of the Gods match, like, has to put the medallion in its holder. Like, it's so cool. But you have the Gift of the Gods title that you carry around. You can defend it, but you also get to cash it in when you're ready for a shot at the Lucha Underground Championship. With 1 week's notice, you can cash in. So you don't have to worry about carrying around or winning a briefcase. The secondary championship is inherently an important one because it will literally, I mean, it will be a stepping stone to you getting a world championship match. So I like that aspect of it too. You have this quote unquote secondary title, but it's an important one, right? Everybody wants their hands on it. It's not something, it would be very difficult to make that title meaningless the way that we've seen so many meaningless secondary titles in WWE in the past. So they have the Lucha Underground title, the Gift of the Gods title, and they have a set of trios tag team belts. Instead of having the women wrestle the men, if it were me, I would add a women's title because they have a lot of pretty badass ladies there in that company. And then you're all set. That's all you need. Four should be the maximum number if it were up to me. You can make exceptions to that, but any more than that, and I think it's too much. And I'm fascinated by your city. I can't let this go. I have to look this up online. Tunkhannock, Pennsylvania. I've not heard of that before. Tunkhannock, Pennsylvania. Let's see. According to the fine folks at Wikipedia, Tunkhannock is a borough in Wyoming County, Pennsylvania, 31 miles northwest of Wilkes-Barre. So it's not a city. Today, many residents are employed by the Procter & Gamble plant in nearby Washington Township. As of the 2010 census, the borough population was 1,836. Wow. It's not a lot of people there in Tunkhannock, which is pretty impressive that I got an email from somebody who lives there. Okay, that's your history lesson or geography lesson for the day. Dylan from La Crosse, Wisconsin. I listen to your podcast every week and you keep predicting that AJ Styles will win the Royal Rumble. But what if you're wrong and it comes down to all three members of the Shield and Roman Reigns wins the Royal Rumble? Well, they're back in Philadelphia for the Royal Rumble next year. That's where they were for the Royal Rumble in 2015. If they do that, then they're just trolling the fans at this point. They have to realize where they're going to be for that Rumble show. And if they're going to work so hard to get people to like Roman by putting him in the Shield, and they're banking on this to get people to like the guy, then I would say the single worst thing they could possibly do is have him win the Royal Rumble in Philadelphia. I think they're much better off having someone from SmackDown win the Rumble and then having the Raw person, probably Reigns, win an Elimination Chamber match to get a shot at Brock Lesnar. Sal, from Chicago, who would you say was the biggest What a Difference a Year Makes victim? What I mean is, if you look at someone like Benoit or Daniel Bryan, 1 year they're winning the main event of WrestleMania, and the next they're relegated to a multiple-man ladder match. Those examples were just off the top of my head. I'm sure there are worse. First one that comes to my mind is Demolition. I was a big Demolition mark as a kid. Still am. That's why it was so cool I got to interview them earlier this year. But look at Demolition. They win the tag team titles of WrestleMania 6, right? 67,000 people losing their minds. A year later, WrestleMania 7, they're losing to two Japanese guys that have never even wrestled for WWE. A day in their life. I mean, I don't know if Tenryu did at some point wrestle for them, maybe, but two guys out of nowhere that weren't even in WWF. They bring these guys in and they beat Demolition. A sad end for one of their best tag teams. Miz is another one. He goes from teaming with Big Show, right, in the opening match, WrestleMania 26, I knew he was in the opening match. I couldn't remember who it was with, so I looked it up. It was Big Show. Opening match of WrestleMania 26 in a tag match. WrestleMania 27, he's headlining and beating John Cena. He's the WWE champion headlining and beating John Cena a year later. What a difference a year makes indeed. And then, and I guess this doesn't count because it was 2 years later, but with Miz, if you fast forward to WrestleMania 29, the guy isn't even on the main card. He's on the pre-show wrestling Wade Barrett. So it's from the WrestleMania main event to the kickoff show within 2 years. That's quite the up and down there for the Miz. The other one I could think of, I'll give you a more recent example, Shinsuke Nakamura. How's that for a more recent example? The guy goes from beating Samoa, forget everything he was doing in Japan. He goes from beating Samoa Joe to win the NXT title at SummerSlam weekend in Brooklyn to a year later losing to Jinder Mahal at SummerSlam. Now, I know it was for the WWE title and all. There are worse positions to be in, but still, it's Jinder Mahal. Let's see. You mentioned Judgment Day 2000 and Undertaker's return last week and talked about the botched timing at the end. I didn't watch too much back then, so I went back on the network to take a look. It seemed like it was quite hectic, starting from when Shawn Michaels got knocked off the apron. Triple H no-sells the Rock Bottom, the camera barely catches Undertaker riding down to the ring on a motorcycle, and the whole chokeslam tombstone DQ fiasco at the end. What was supposed to happen? I'm not familiar with the storyline back then. Was it supposed to end in a tie, or was Triple H always scheduled to win the match by DQ? Anything's possible. I mean, they did hotshot the title right back onto Rock in a six-man tag at the King of the Ring the next month, but I don't believe he was supposed to win. The plan all along was for Triple H to win the championship back. In fact, I know that the Torch and the Observer newsletters back then talked about what was supposed to happen, and some of the details might have been a little bit different, but the plan was for Shawn Michaels. So again, this, you guys know that this is one of my favorite matches. I think Undertaker's return on that show is the best return they've ever, had for any wrestler in the company. Most exciting. So I'm very familiar with this match and what the two newsletters were reporting at the time. Michaels was supposed to warn the Undertaker, don't tombstone Triple H, but he was going to go ahead and tombstone him anyway. And then Shawn Michaels would call for the DQ. There would still be time left, though, so the match would not be over at that point. Shawn would call for the bell, Triple H would win by DQ, he'd be up 6-5, but there was still going to be however many seconds left in the match. Rock would then crawl over, go to cover Triple H, but time would expire, and Triple H would win by default 6-5. That's how it was supposed to happen. Now, I think Triple H, he took a pedigree, I think, on the announce desk a little before the finish. That knocked him a little loopy. Apparently, it took him a little too long to recover from that and to get back in the ring, and so that caused a lot of time to tick off the clock. That didn't help when it came to the timing of everything. But that, and between that and waiting 30 seconds too long to play the Undertaker's music, it created the situation where they had to basically throw the finish out the window. And thank God Undertaker got that chokeslam in on Triple H a few seconds before the actual time would have expired, because they were able to point to that and say, oh, it wasn't the tombstone, it was the chokeslam. Shawn Michaels saw the chokeslam, and he called for the DQ, and they were able to kind of save their ass that way. But that gives you a better sense of what happened there at the end. Gianfranco from Chicago, what is your favorite match in history where the heel was victorious? You know what? It might just be that Iron Man match I just talked about with Triple H beating The Rock. I'd say if not that one, though, I would go with Kurt Angle beating Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 21. The Bruiser from Boston. If you had to choose a few matches to show somebody who's never seen Kurt Angle wrestle before, what would you choose? Jesus, how much time do we have here? Just off the top of my head, Kurt Angle, Chris Benoit, Royal Rumble 2003. Kurt Angle, Shawn Michaels, WrestleMania 21. Kurt Angle, Rey Mysterio, SummerSlam 2002. Kurt Angle, Undertaker and Rock from Vengeance in 2002. That awesome triple threat match. Let's see, what else would I throw in there? I feel like I'm leaving out so many good ones. I mean, Angle and Austin had some pretty good matches in 01. I think I remember liking their SummerSlam match better than their Unforgiven match until the finish. The SummerSlam finish was kind of shitty. So I throw that one in there. Maybe SummerSlam 01 against Austin. Angle had a lot of good TV matches too. Those are the ones that stand out to me, though. I would say those would be the big ones. Oh, you know what? The world title match he had with Undertaker, No Way Out, 2006. I'd throw that one on there as well. Let's see here. Frank in Atlanta. I was listening to the Edge and Christian podcast, and they were talking about the genesis of the Attitude Era. They mentioned that Goldust was the first to push the envelope in 1996 before Steve Austin. I remember you saying in a previous podcast that there were signs of the Attitude Era as early as 96, and it made me wonder, should Goldust get more credit for being the one to bring Attitude to the WWF at the time? I remember as a kid, seeing a character like that really was a first in all types of media. Goldust absolutely deserves credit, but I think if you're going to credit anybody with being the first to bring sort of what would be considered an early version of Attitude to WWE, it has to be Kevin Nash. And I think it goes back to the end of 1995. It goes back even further. 95 was an awful year for WWE. Just terrible. Just the absolute shits. It was the only year, I've said this before, you know, growing up a wrestling fan, being a fan for all these years, it was the only year. I remember, too, February of 95 was the closest I ever came to just calling it quits and saying, I am done. Like, it is so boring. But I stuck with it. But 95 has some gems in it. You know, there's some actually really good matches from 95. Shawn and Razor had that ladder rematch. Guys like Owen Hart and Hakushi and 1-2-3 Kid. Like, there were some good things about it. But overall, as a year, it was absolute just total shit. All these goofy gimmicks. Vince McMahon was having like an acid trip at the time. That was the year that we got the Goon. And we had Alex the Pug Porto. And we had TL Hopper. And we had... Freddie Joe Floyd, and we just, oh my god, on and on and on with this awful nonsense. I don't know what he was on at the time. So when Diesel turned heel at Survivor Series that year, it was different to see him come out on TV the next night and cut the kind of promo that he did, right? He was a bad guy, but only to the people who didn't support him. So like if you were wearing one of the black Diesel gloves and you were in the first few rows, he'd give you a fist bump on the way to the ring. He was seeking out those people who were, which is smart, by the way. Kevin Nash, always the one to think about how to make a buck. If you're wearing my merch, I'll give you a fist bump, right? So, hey, come to the shows, buy the black gloves, and I'll be happy to give you a fist bump. And if not, fuck off. See, Kevin Nash truly is the smartest man in all of wrestling. But that was something we really hadn't seen at that time. He became the cool heel in a lot of ways. Not the way the NWO was in WCW, but... Before Stone Cold, there was Diesel. He flipped The Undertaker off at the end of the Royal Rumble in 96. He threatened to beat up Vince McMahon at that In Your House show before he wrestled Shawn Michaels in April. That was a full year and a half before Steve Austin actually did beat up Vince McMahon. On that same show, at that In Your House show, he ripped off Mad Dog Vachon's fake leg to use as a weapon. Nash ushered Attitude into that company at the end of 95, and I think the only reason people don't really credit him for it is because that run was cut really short when he gave notice that he was leaving to go to WCW. That, and there's just a lot of people who just don't like Kevin Nash and don't want to give him credit for it, but he deserves it. I mean, you got to call a spade. I think he deserves credit. Go back and watch that post-Survivor Series promo where he walks out in the middle of one of the matches, right in the middle of the show. He saunters on down to the ring, and he's in work shoot mode. He goes into work shoot mode on the company and how for an entire year I was the corporate champion and they wouldn't let me be myself. And it's the kind of promo that, like, if Roman Reigns walked out in the middle of a random match on Raw tomorrow night and cut a promo like that, people would wet themselves. And he would be a lot better off for it. That just wasn't something you saw in WWE back then. That version of Diesel, I think, would have been far more interesting than the version we got as champion for a year. Ariel from Santo Domingo, buy or sell on the more controversial ending, Starrcade 97, Hogan versus Sting, or Starrcade 98, Kevin Nash ending Goldberg's undefeated streak? I'm going to buy on Hogan and Sting. I think Goldberg and Nash... I don't know that it was so much controversial as much as it was just flat out stupid in a lot of people's eyes. Nash just should not have been the guy to end the streak. Like, if they were going to do it, I know there's a lot of opinion they should have never ended the streak. I mean, never is a long time. At some point, that streak had to come to an end. But as far as Starrcade that year, I think, you know, it didn't have to be then. But you know what? If you were going to do it, I believe that DDP was the guy. I think that match at Halloween Havoc in October of 98, I think, and here we are now, 19 years later, I think that was the time. I think DDP was, you know, him and Goldberg, right? Those two guys, and Booker T, you could say also, but I think in terms of like a really, really hot attraction, it was Goldberg and DDP were the two really kind of big original stars that WCW made during that whole Monday Night War period. You know, I'd put Booker below them, I'd put Scott Steiner even a level below. But DDP was hot as hell at that time with the crowds, and that Diamond Cutter finish was probably second, maybe only to the Stunner, I'd say, is as the most popular finish in all of wrestling. People would freak out. He can hit it from any angle. It was really cool. I think he should have been the one at Halloween Havoc to end that streak, but that's neither here nor there. The follow-up to Starrcade with the finger poke, that was just beyond insane for them to do that. Sting and Hogan, though, like, even though Sting did win and they did the whole celebration at the end, he's the champ, everybody comes out to celebrate with him, finally the NWO has been beaten. To this day, there's still controversy over what happened with that finish. Eric Bischoff can't do a podcast interview or a radio interview without being asked about that Hogan-Sting finish at Starrcade in 97. They're not asking him about Goldberg and Nash at Starrcade in 98. They're asking him about Hogan and Sting from 97, because it's still to this day a controversial thing to talk about. Like, did Hogan tell the referee not to fast count and make Sting look bad? Which I believe he did. The answer is yes. Not only did Sting end up looking like a fool because Hogan pinned him clean, Bret Hart came out there looking like a total bully, punching out the referee. The referee made a fair count. He was just doing his job. He didn't do anything wrong. The only way they could have booked that match more poorly than they did would have been to just have Hogan straight up beat Sting and keep the championship. He did beat Sting, as it turned out, but they gave Sting the belt anyway. That's basically what happened. And we have Dan from Niagara Falls, New York. If I recall correctly, you said that John Cena's best rival was CM Punk. Now it would be understandable to say the same about Punk's best feud. I believe the only one that came close was his rivalry with Jeff Hardy in 2009. Who do you believe was the best opposite to CM Punk? Jeff Hardy in 09 or John Cena in 2011? I'm going to buy on John Cena. The Jeff Hardy feud, it was cool and all, right? Straight edge guy against, I guess, the decidedly not straight edge guy. And they had some good matches. They had the TLC match at SummerSlam. They had the cage match on SmackDown. But I still think that whole dynamic with Cena being the squeaky clean PG face of the company and Punk being the opposite and Punk feeling disrespected and very much not what they had in mind as their sort of quote-unquote corporate champion. It was a nice balance between two guys who were very different. It helped that Punk was cutting the kind of promos he was cutting. John Cena was the biggest star in the entire company. I guess similar in a lot of ways, right? Because Jeff Hardy, you could argue, was one of the biggest stars in all of wrestling at that time. I mean, my God, there was a period from like 08 to 09 where Jeff Hardy, you could argue, was number one, if not number two. But the Cena Punk stuff to me was just so much better. And that Money in the Bank match in 2011 was friggin' magic. You know, the crowd in Chicago, it was just, you can't replicate that. You know what I mean? You can't. And so I can't vote against that. I got to go with Punk and Cena. I'm going to buy on that and sell on the Jeff Hardy feud. So that's going to do it for the mailbag. Keep emailing me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Again, I'm doing a TV Tracks Q&A in the next week or two. Right now, the video is up on the Tracks channel where you can submit questions in the comment section. So hop on that if you would like to participate in that. That'll be exclusive to his channel. He's been a big supporter of the podcast, so I try to do stuff like that every now and then. It's the least I can do for all of his support, so I thank him for that. My Wolfgang interview, please, if you haven't already, check it out. Even if you're not familiar with him or the UK wrestling scene, we talk WWE, we talk, you know, his time and some of the matches in NXT. It's not just about the UK scene. We pretty much talk about everything. And he's a cool dude. So if you're not familiar with him, you will be after this interview. Head on over to YouTube and give the video a thumbs up, if you would be so kind to do that. Some of you guys have been asking me about the whole 10-year anniversary show. What's the plan? When is it going to be? I was going to kind of make an announcement here, but I'm still a little unsure on dates. I'm pretty sure I have a date locked in for it. I'm airing, or aiming, I should say, for that first Saturday night in November to do something very similar to what I did for episode 500, do a live cast on YouTube. And, you know, we'll have a live chat going and we'll take phone calls and, you know, otherwise it would be a normal show, but we'll incorporate, you know, you guys in there in some way and make it more interactive. I don't know that I'll be on video this time, but doing a live show, I think, is the plan. I know there's a UFC show from Madison Square Garden that night. There may be a World Series game that night. That's something I can't help. I mean, I don't know if there will be or not. But that is kind of what it's looking like right now. I'll have a firmer announcement next weekend. I'll let you guys know what the firm date is next weekend. But the plan is to do another YouTube live stream like we did back in June. So get ready for that. That should be a lot of fun. 10-year anniversary episode. And a lot of stuff going on, man. I mean, we got that coming up. Next weekend is Hell in a Cell. So I'll be doing a Hell in a Cell review on the YouTube channel. I'm doing the Q&A for TV Tracks on his channel. The WWE 2K18 Steam release is this Tuesday. I've already got my pre-order in, and I'll be playing that and doing some Sound of Gamers on that. I've got a DVD review. I haven't done one of those in a while. I've got one of those planned as soon as I actually finish the DVD that I'm watching. That'll go up on the YouTube channel in the next few weeks. So there's lots of content coming your way. Your support is always appreciated, be it via PayPal or just by grabbing that JR book for free using our Audible link. I will see you guys for episode 518 next weekend. We'll have Hell in a Cell predictions then. Until then, be well, stay safe. We'll be back for more Sound Off next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solid Monster sounds off.
Mundo goes to leave, and Taya says, "Wait, aren't you going to put any pants on?" He just goes, "No time for pants," and he walks off. That also happens to be Randy Orton's philosophy in life. My philosophy, too. You see, you don't know if I'm wearing pants right now or not, do you? You can't see. I could be wearing nothing right now for all you know. No time for pants.
Solid Monster sounds off.
Since 2007, The Solid Monster sounds off. Available at thesolidmonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solid Monster sound off.